A quick note before we start this podcast. We tease a Casablanca podcast at the end of this Maltese Falcon episode. That's not going to happen next week. James and I have schedules that are difficult to plan around right now, so we've got to take the next 2 weeks off. But yeah, we'll be back with a Casablanca podcast in a couple weeks. In the meantime, we're going to rerun old episodes that we liked quite a bit. And if you miss those, you can listen. And if you listen before, you can listen to them again because they're going to be about exclusively really good movies. Speaking of which, The Maltese Falcon.
Welcome to the government. I'm Alex, and that bird that you heard on the other end of things is actually James, my co-podcaster. Before we get started, check out our website, themcgovernment.com. We've talked about a lot of good movies this year. Inherent Vice, Eyes Wide Shut, Sunset Boulevard, Dog Day Afternoon, Inside Man, and most recently Boyhood. I skipped over Top Gun because it's not a great movie, but we've also talked about that.
But it was a great podcast.
It was a good podcast. I enjoyed it. But yeah, follow us on Twitter as well at the MacGuffin Men, all one word, no underscores. And tell your friends about us. Tell your friends to subscribe to us on iTunes and tell random people to send us money for no reason, just because we could use money. Money's
Ooh,
always makes the world go around.
can I do a quick shout out?
Absolutely.
Shout out to Walsh, who told me he listens.
Oh, yeah, shout out to Walsh. Assuming this is the same Walsh.
Yes, it is.
I'm sorry about LaShawn
Yeah, he saw that Top Gun was coming up, and he specifically texted me to make sure I give it the shit that he felt it deserved, and he's in for a rude awakening.
McCoy. All right. Well, shout outs to Walsh. But yeah, we got a pretty famous MacGuffin to talk about today, so let's just get the MacGuffin men right on the case.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James. What are we talking about?
We're talking about the Maltese Falcon, which has a very prominent MacGuffin, is named after the MacGuffin of this movie. So, this is a long time coming. So, here we go.
First bogey podcast, first John Huston podcast, unless we're counting Chinatown, which I don't think we are, but
No, I don't think we are.
Yeah. But he is
Yes.
great in Chinatown.
Yeah, this was a long time coming. I think it's been on our to-do list for a while, and you let me choose the movie this week, and
I'm MacGuffin first, another MacGuffin first.
I went for one that I did not need to talk you into at all, so maybe I made the wrong choice.
Yeah, you definitely did. This was your Adam Sandler week, and you fucked it up.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we are talking about The Maltese Falcon, which came out in 1941 and is directed by John Huston, as you said, and was based on a novel written by Dashiell Hammett. Is that what we're going with?
That's always been my understanding of pronunciation.
So Dash wrote this novel. No, but it's a very, very well-respected detective novel, sometimes listed as one of the best English novels ever written. And this is actually the third attempt at making it into a Hollywood movie. Did you know that?
I did as of earlier today.
Okay.
And I shrugged and said, well, I guess reboots work sometimes.
Yeah, I point to this one and Wizard of Oz to point out that remakes aren't always horrible
Yeah,
ideas.
okay.
But yeah, very well-respected novel, and a novel that John Huston cared a lot about, and had seen the two earlier incarnations of it, and was not a big fan of those. There's one made in 1931 and one made in 1936. And as John Huston was about to experience, studios like to put pressure on directors to have happy endings to their movies at this point in Hollywood. Which doesn't really go in with much of the theme of the novel or the 1941 version that we're talking about today. Not a terribly upbeat movie.
No. No. I like that for a decade period in Hollywood, it was every 5 years the Maltese Falcon was getting
Yeah,
released. You know,
I know.
like clockwork, it's 1941, time for another Maltese.
Yes, but John Huston was under the same pressure to try to make a positive ending. I mean, I read the synopses of the other ones, and yeah, there are much. I think overall, they say the tone is a lot lighter, and I think at the end of the 1931 one, Sam Spade becomes like assistant district attorney and uses his power to have O'Shaughnessy's like prison stay made a lot better, and he visits. Of, which is not the ending that this relationship sees in this film.
No.
No.
But maybe in the Return of the Maltese Falcon. That
yeah. But anyway, we'll quickly talk about our boy Dash a little bit longer.
Sure.
He was a private investigator. He actually worked for the Pinkertons in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the characters in this movie are based on people who... you know, he worked with or he worked for as a private investigator. Pretty much the only one he says is doesn't have an original is Sam Spade. And that's someone he said private investigators think they are or try to come close to being. But no one's actually, you know, as cool and as talented as Sam Spade is in this movie, mm-hmm. which I think is a fair assessment of this character.
Yeah, probably.
He's not the most likable guy, but he's very good at his job.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, if nothing else, his closest coworker dies and he takes less than half a beat to process that sadness. You know,
yeah.
It's just like it's like me getting a call in the middle of the night. James is dead. And then just me going rolling over and going back to bed and not caring at all. It's basically yeah. about what happens.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about should we talk about this movie now?
Yeah, of course.
Is that enough foundation?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. How did you like it?
I think it's quite good. Yeah. I liked it quite a bit.
Okay.
And you?
Yeah, I adored it. I thought it was fantastic. it's got some awesome 40s dialogue.
Oh my God. What is the thing he says where it's like, oh, you birds cracking foxy. That's that's the highlight God. For me. I loved
it. Yeah, I was losing it there. That's just, that's too good.
That sounds like spoof 40s noir dialogue. Like it's that good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about, this movie kind of gets us started pretty quickly. You know, we have our femme fatale. We have our female private investigator customer who mm-hmm. is a staple of the film noir genre. Mm-hmm. And then we get two murders pretty quickly after she sends Miles out on this case. Mm-hmm. And from that point, I mean, things are pretty on pretty early in this movie.
Oh, yeah. It's a very... quickly paced movie as far as things happening, you know, like they jam a lot of plot into what I think is just 101 minutes. You know, it's pretty fast paced, all things considered.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree, and it's not as though they do this with you know, tons of chase scenes and shootouts. They just have a lot of plot points they get through, and it's just a good little narrative of deception and, you know, setting people up and not knowing who to trust and mistaken identity and being accused for crimes you didn't commit. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the two murders right away is something that I can't think of that I saw in another movie that, you know, he's suspected of murdering the one guy and then murdering the second one, which makes murdering the first guy kind of pointless. It's good. And yeah, as you said, like it kind of just gets started right away and it moves along at a really good clip and a lot happens for, you know, a relatively short movie.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And there's a lot of, I don't know, like the movie never really slows down to explain things to the viewer as well, which I enjoyed quite a bit.
Yeah.
It seems like pretty much every time something is clarified, there's also something new being added to the mix as well. You know?
Yeah.
So, like while Sam is learning the history of the Maltese Falcon, he's being drugged, and then we have that to be taken into consideration going forward. So, yeah, it's interesting the way that this movie moves along.
Yeah, do you want to talk about that drugging scene?
Oh, I mean, I think that scene's definitely the most interesting in the movie to me, because I think it's sort of it works as this little. You know, so it sort of sums up everything that I feel like the movie's kind of about. I like that it's paired the first, like both scenes with the fat man, his first scene and the second scene, I think work really well together in concert. And there's not much time in between the two. Bogart basically just leaves and then comes back. But yeah, in the first scene, they're having a discussion, Fat Man and Spade, and the Fat Man's physically dominant, shot from a low angle and close up. And it's a really nice, gorgeous close up. And then we typically see Sam Spade in wider shots, and he's just smaller in the frame. So Fat Man's very much in control. I mean, he's also physically much larger, but it's still meant to represent control, right? And then in the second scene, we get Spade coming back. And Spade sits on the couch instead of the chair, but the Fat Man sits in the same chair, but he's now pointing in a different direction, right? So it's the same setup of the scene. They're sitting and drinking and smoking cigars, but things are slightly askew from how they were before, as Spade will eventually find out. And the way that the Fat Man tells the story of the Maltese Falcon, all he's doing really is buying time until Spade passes out from the Mickey he has been slipped, quote unquote. And I think that really stands in for, you know, the feeling of what the Maltese Falcon is supposed to be, right? The end, we find out that the thing they've all been chasing is nothing. They're chasing nothingness, and or at least the Maltese Falcon in this movie is a fake. And what the Fat Man is basically doing is telling him these stories of this thing that he should believe in, this thing that he wants to chase, this thing he cares so much about. And all it ends up doing is basically lulling him to sleep, you know? And it really means nothing. And I found that whole scene very interesting.
Yeah. And I love, like, it's a great scene it's the scene people talk about visually the most, just like that 7.5 minute take, which is pretty spectacular. Mm-hmm. But no, what you're saying about the drug thing, I love it. And I love that you don't see him put it in. You know, here's a little spoiler for the movie Kingsman. There is a drink drugging scene in that movie, and, you know, they kind of give it away very visually, and you know something's about to happen with their drinks. This, you don't get any indication. Fat Man just kind of talks for longer than you would think is really necessary, really fleshes out the story when very little of this is relevant to Sam Spade and mm-hmm. his work as a private investigator. And as you said, we're falling into the same trap that Sam is. We're just not really aware of what's to happen. We're focusing so much more on the story, which, you know, as is often the case with the MacGuffin, is completely useless. It's just to drive the action. It's just to get the characters motivated. And, you know, in this scene, it's just listening as a private investigator, mm-hmm. and he's getting drugged and he passes out. And it's not even the MacGuffin. It's this, what it may not even be true story about the MacGuffin that, you know, pushes the story along and allows the next plot point to happen, which I think is really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just love that we have no indication. We didn't know until it's too late. And then, you know, we kind of just get the camera, you know, unfocuses and refocuses. And it's a really small indication that something's going wrong. But it's, mm-hmm. you know, like everything in this movie, it is very deliberate, and serves its narrative function very quickly.
Yeah, for sure. And another thing I really liked about that scene is that, I mean, the Fat Man, just his nickname, and the fact that he seems to be a very active capitalist, I suppose you could say. I think that really sort of, it made me think that the Maltese Falcon is sort of like this unattainable goal that people are always going to strive for. Like, I thought of it as like the American dream, you know, and like this guy just wants money and is willing to do whatever he can to get it. And the Maltese Falcon is just the thing that is how he can achieve the most success at this moment. And so he's chasing it with, you know, with blinders on, basically. He's willing to throw away a guy that's like a son to him because there's only one Maltese Falcon and you can have another son. And I thought that was a really interesting sort of look at the folly of chasing the money, basically. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, just to kind of contextualize this is 1941, so the country's still reeling from, you know, the Great Depression, not really the greatest decade, the 30s that mm-hmm. they had just come out of. So, I mean, to put that into context, film noir, and this movie, as I said in particular, I think is pretty pessimistic.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone's going to argue with me on that one. And yeah, we have this fat man character whose real last name is Gutman, which I think is wonderful. played by Sidney Greenstreet, who was, he was a stage actor for about 40 years, and this was his film debut. And I thought he was fantastic in this.
Yeah, he's very good.
Yeah,
it's a weirdly modern performance for 1941. Yeah,
and it's just a weird character because he is so likable, like in the way he speaks with people, and then he's willing to sell out someone he thinks of as a kid. He's as his child. I mean, he's willing to, whether it's you see him debate whether it's going to be Cairo or it's going to be the kid, as they call him, but he's going to have one of these people he's known and worked with for many years just go to jail for something that they all kind of did together. But it's just a very magnetic performance. Like, there's something very his discussions with Sam Spade, I really enjoy when it's just the two of them speaking. And obviously we talked about those two scenes a bit, but those two playing off each other, I think, is really, really good.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's just there's kind of an understanding between them. They're different people. They have different goals. And, well, some parts of the movie they have the same goal, which is to make some money off the Maltese Falcon. But I really just like their back and forth together a lot. And I thought it was I think Greenstreet, I think, stands out as the performer in this movie, even though Bogart's really good.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I would agree.
Yeah. What do you want to talk about, Cairo and the kid, I guess?
Sure. I mean, I guess I don't have much to say. Like, do you have thoughts?
Well, just from the production aspect, this is a time when the production code is causing serious changes in scripts and a lot of pressure being applied on screenwriters and directors to make movies a certain way and not show a certain type of person, to put it delicately. And so in the novel, it's very clear that Joel Cairo is a homosexual. Like, it's stated as a fact. And, people call him a fairy. He does have a very effeminate manner, but it's also made clear that he's literally homosexual. In 1941, you couldn't show that. You couldn't have someone be a known homosexual on camera. So, they have his effeminate manner. They have him kind of filleting his cane the first time you really see him. And so it's just interesting to see this movie is so similar to the book in so many ways. Like, the dialogue is lifted. The plot really isn't changed in the 1941 version as it had been in the 1931 and the 36.
Yeah.
And so, we just have to dance around this issue with Cairo, who, has his business card scented with gardenias and all these kinds of things.
Yeah.
So, it's just watching them negotiate that. I mean, it's throughout the movie. There's even questions about whether Wilmer is homosexual as well, which is the kid, the gunman that works closely with Fat Man. And I mean, that his homosexuality is hinted at in the book, and then really, really played down here. It's more of a father-son relationship. I mean, in the novel, he was referred to as a gunsel, which is kind of like the younger boy toy in a homosexual couple. And yeah.
Isn't he called that at one point in this movie?
Yeah. That term snuck in because it was kind of just an unknown term. And everyone kind of in context just thought it meant fall guy. And so you'll see a lot of novels and books, a lot of novels and films after this movie came out, use the term gunsel in the manner people thought it meant, but not really the true manner, which I thought was interesting. Like, as a result of trying to get homosexuality out of cinema, they kind of unwittingly leaked part of it into the lexicon, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, another thing I found interesting, because I did think a little bit about this. It's weird that these quote unquote standards that kept homosexuality out of this movie probably stopped it from being homophobic. Like, if this movie didn't have restrictions on, if they could have characterized Cairo, how the novel did in 1941. Like now, we would be talking about how this movie is incredibly homophobic, instead yeah. of how the Hollywood's homophobia covered up. like how we talk about how so many old movies are supremely racist now because Hollywood didn't have a problem with you being incredibly racist, but it had a problem with you showing homosexuality in your film at all, and it like probably kind of covered up or kind of stopped a lot of movies that are very good from the time being seen as incredibly homophobic down the line, even just by yeah. accident. You know, it's not an intentional thing on their part. It was homophobia at the beginning, but it just sort of, I don't know, it kind of makes the movies last more somehow, which is weird.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a double-edged sword, obviously. I mean, there's good parts, and I think that was just kind of a accidental positive effect
yeah, absolutely.
Of the production code, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Obviously, there's terrible things like, you know, just homosexuals not being represented and, you know, yeah. made to feel like they're not part of society. But, you know, I think you're right that it was a unintended consequence that we don't have the, like, you know, we don't see depictions of them being treated the way they really would, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, exactly.
And then some other production code things that caused changes to this movie was Sam Spade in the novels is a raging alcoholic and is drinking constantly. Uh-huh. And like, even in this movie, the drinking is heavily toned down, even though there's a fair amount of boozing going on.
Yeah.
And the cigarette smoking as well was toned down. Mm-hmm. And it led to a funny story where Jack L. Warner, who ran WB at the time.
Yep.
Didn't want people smoking on screen because he thought people smoking on screen would cause the audience members to have the urge for a smoke and would leave the theater. And so he would, you know, he would say most movies can't have a lot of smoking. And John Huston didn't like that and, you know, thought like visually the smoke ended up being such a huge part of mm-hmm. film noir from an aesthetic standpoint. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is a time when people smoked way more than they do now. And a lot of this movie has people in very stressful situations, mm-hmm. Which would cause you to smoke more. So, kind of as a, you know, a bit of a spiteful move on John Huston's part, he had everyone smoking constantly throughout the movie. And then, Jack Warner saw some of the, got very upset at them and said, okay, you're not allowed to smoke at all. And he kind of, his little prank kind of backfired because he thought, you know, we need the smoke for the visual elements that we want in this film. We want to show how stressful that final scene is by having everyone smoke. So in the end, they kind of found a balance in between. There is smoking in this movie, but not a ridiculous amount.
Yeah.
John Huston sounds like a really interesting guy.
Interesting and probably terrible guy. Yes, that is true.
Yeah.
Alcoholic, womanizer, but also Renaissance man. Like,
yeah,
former professional boxer, painter, writer. It's he has had a fascinating life. He refers to one of his ex-wife as a crocodile in his autobiography. One of his five ex-wives, sorry.
Yeah, they said they said he's also often thought of as the Ernest Hemingway of cinema, which I think goes to your point of being fascinating and probably a horrible person.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. I was doing a little research on him and either his first or second wife, I forget, but after she divorced John Huston, ended up marrying who most people think is the prime suspect in the Black Dahlia murder, like before the Black Dahlia murder, and that's just a weird couple of husbands to have.
Wow.
But I found that quite fascinating.
He's got a type.
But yeah, no, John Huston's very interesting, and I like his, I mean, his directing style is a type of style that is really interesting to me. Somebody that can make a very good movie in a very precise manner. Like reading about it, the best modern comparison is to talk about Christopher Nolan, just in the way that Huston's movies, he would always shoot them in a specific way to minimize the amount of editing he had to do. And to sort of make everything important so that nothing could get cut by the studio, because he'd always have a good reason for something to be there, and he would sort of, his movies would be basically cut in his head while he was doing the film, and as such, very regularly came in under budget and under like early, like his movies were done early, which is almost which is extremely uncommon in Hollywood, like, and to
except for Clint Eastwood.
Well, yeah exactly, it's Clint Eastwood and Christopher Nolan are the two people now that do that. Christopher Nolan, like, Interstellar comes out in November, I think, and it was, well, definitely comes out in November, sorry, but it was finished in June or July, like 100% done in June or July, which is very uncommon. Like Joss Whedon is still working on the Avengers 2 right now, or yeah, the Avengers 2 right now, but yeah, and Houston was very big on that, and he sort of viewed it as a way of protecting the movie, that if he shot only exactly what he needed and nothing more, he knew what should be in the picture, and he knew how everything would help the movie, and yeah, and it was just sort of, it was a personal protection sort of thing, and also because he was a man that didn't see any point in doing something just to have done it. You know, he wanted to, always had a purpose for what he was doing in filmmaking.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that comes with someone who's had an interesting life and worked so many different jobs. You know, you I just don't get the sense that he had different jobs because he was really bad and kept getting fired, you know? Like,
no, yeah, exactly.
He's just someone who, as you said, a Renaissance man, and someone who approached the discipline, I think, in a certain way, which was the most effective, like, efficient way to do things.
Yeah.
And I think it's remarkable. This is John Huston's first movie as a director.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like, considering what a classic this is considered, I mean, we didn't mention it, but, you know, considered by some to be the best movie, like one of the greatest movies ever, starting the film noir trend. Mm-hmm. John Huston went on to make, you know, a bunch of many, many more classics throughout his career. Mm-hmm. But I mean, for this to be your first movie as a director, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, we talked about Billy Wilder's first movie being Sunset Boulevard a few weeks ago. And yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah. And so I guess you kind of read everything about how he approached making this movie, eh?
Like the way he would storyboard?
Yeah, like he just storyboarded everything, like, yeah, like every camera angle, every cut, as you said, like there just wasn't like nothing really changed from when things were filmed to when they were put together. The original the shooting script that they went with is exactly the same script that you see in the movie. Like,
yeah,
that's in, which is incredible to know your project that well inside and out before it's even started, to have it perfectly like that is so impressive.
Yeah, exactly. And that sort of extensive storyboarding is very uncommon. Steven Spielberg was famous for doing it, at least in the early part of his career. I don't know if he continued that for his entire career, but yeah, that is.
And Hitchcock did it.
Yes. Yeah. And but yeah, there are not a lot of people that do that. Yeah. So, because it's a lot of fucking work.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely, it is. It's a lot of work that you're not the one being paid to do that. Like, yeah, if you don't do that, they'll get someone to storyboard and things like that. But, you know, I think you used the best word for him. He's a very deliberate director. You know, this is a movie where a lot of stuff happens and it's not that long. There's just kind of nothing wasted in this movie, which is, I think, one of the best compliments you can pay to an artist in any field, right?
Yeah, and his good movies, his more famous movies seem to be, keep a lot of that as well. Like The Treasure of Sierra Madre is such an efficient movie, too. You know, yeah, it's really interesting that way.
Right on. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Humphrey Bogart. Sorry.
Sure.
As you said, this is kind of our first podcast discussing him.
Yep.
And is one of the biggest movie stars of all time. And, mm-hmm, you know, after this movie, definitely one of the biggest stars working on the planet.
Well, yeah, for sure. And then the next year was Casablanca. So,
yeah. And I mean, just like John Huston, this is his first movie as a director. People knew Humphrey Bogart, but he was kind of just a B actor. And
he would play the heavy, quote unquote, in the 30s.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, a lot of mob movies and things like that around the time.
It's like Tom Sizemore in the 90s somehow becoming the lead for one of the most famous movies. Like, he plays, I don't know, Russell Crowe's part in A Beautiful Mind somehow, you know, out of nowhere. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just, I mean, it's just really interesting what this movie is historically as a huge jumping off point for John Huston, a huge jumping off point for Humphrey Bogart, who, again, was a known name, but this is what lets him, you know, become the Humphrey Bogart that we know now. Sidney Greenstreet, I mean, who plays Joel Cairo. These are people who would go on to work together several more times and make several very, very well-respected movies. So this movie is, I love this movie on its own. And then you kind of place it historically and what it achieved for so many people who went on to shape the next two decades in cinema. And it's even more remarkable.
Yeah, exactly. And you sort of, and you look at it as the people that also would have seen this movie then sort of growing up to be the movie brats and the Hollywood Renaissance, you know, I'm sure its influence cannot be understated because they would have all seen this movie and probably all loved it because they've made a lot of smart decisions in their movies. So I assume they have a lot of smart decisions in their tastes. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And as I said, I mean, this is what is seen as, like, argued as what's really started the film noir trend. Mm-hmm. And as you said, people watching this movie who would go on to make things in the Hollywood Renaissance. We have things like very moral ambiguous characters. We have, another production code thing that this movie kind of shook was they didn't like having morally ambiguous women, particularly. Mm-hmm. Like, you actually either had to be a very horrible woman or the very angelic kind of Madonna, if you will. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this movie in particular, as I said, kicking off film noir, has that character of a female who we're not really sure throughout the movie and kind of forces us to think of women as possibly whole people who might have different motivations and emotions like a man could. Yeah. So, I mean, just to look at that historically as well, I think it's really interesting for that.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, the kind of not happiest ending, a movie that kind of deals in a lot of these grays, I think really, really enforced what would come out of the Hollywood Renaissance in the 70s.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we talked about it a bit with that scene with the fat man explaining the origin of the Maltese Falcon and how even though it's him and Spade in the room together, they're chasing the same thing. They're kind of very different types of people. Like Sam Spade, like he's a private investigator. He's part of a system of sorts, but he stands outside of that system and not unlike John Huston kind of was. Like, he was a part of Hollywood, but kind of, at least in this movie, and would continue on throughout his career to sort of do things within the Hollywood system in a slightly different way and end up being incredibly influential in how he did those things, you know?
Like, yeah, and
his choices would be very important.
And John Huston's father was, you know, involved in Hollywood as well. I mean, his father, who plays Captain Jacoby in this movie, actually, it's reading about John Huston. He kind of grew up in this and then did a bit of it, kind of got disillusioned by it, left for Europe and lived in Mexico for a bit, and then came back determined to be a serious writer and director. So, you know, it seems as though he kind of could have lived his whole life in Hollywood, but did it a little, came back kind of more determined with broader artistic goals.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. Yeah. But yeah, Sam Spade, very interesting character. Yes. Do we like him? Do you like him?
Oh, I mean, like, as far as a character in a noir movie, yeah, absolutely. I don't want to count him among my friends.
Yeah. He has a code. We know that. Every man has
a man has to have a code.
Yeah. But I mean, I find him likable and I find myself cheering for him. And then, you know, we meet him, as you said, he hears about his partner's death and does very little about it. He kisses his partner's widow one of the first chances he gets when they're alone. He's very cold. I mean, he seems very distant. His speech to O'Shaughnessy once she finds out she's going to jail, I think is a wonderful piece of dialogue. Mm-hmm. Warm you up to the guy, right?
I'm sorry?
Like, it's good dialogue, but it doesn't do anything to warm you up to this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, as we said, sorry, I got on my hind legs, boys, but the news of Miles killing upset me and you birds coming here cracking Foxy. Anyone who says that, I'm gonna get on board with.
Yeah, so I guess you do want to have him as a member of your friend group just to see what ludicrous ludicrous sentences he can pull out.
Yeah, but I mean, just kind of morally speaking, like, yeah. where do you land on him?
Oh, he's a very he doesn't really care about anybody. And I think what's best for Sam Spade, given the moment, like whatever moment he happens to find himself in, is what Sam Spade is going to do. He's doesn't really care about other people, I don't think.
No, he seems to be at least nice to his secretary, Effie, but...
yeah, but she is, like, very much there to serve him, you know? Like, she does what he asks her to do, you know?
Right.
I feel like the second she didn't do that, he'd be like, what? you know, and be like, just be like, okay, you're a criminal now. I'm taking you to jail. I'm going to plant something on you and you're going to jail.
You're going over.
yeah, exactly.
As they say. Yeah. But I just mean...
She really is amazing. She's amazing at her job, by the way. We should point that out.
Oh, well, the part where, like, his receptionist shows up to a stolen artifact ring / murder scene.
Yeah.
Like, that's... I think that's above and beyond your duty.
Oh yeah, no, she's very talented. He calls her an angel many times over the course of the movie. All of them deserved, I think.
All deserved. yeah. Okay, what about O'Shaughnessy?
I mean, she's a murderer, right?
She is.
So I don't know. I feel like I don't have any feelings for her either way, really.
No. What about
sorry
to the other ones as a femme fatale, kind of compared to the other ones you're familiar with?
I don't know. I feel like noir is kind of your game. I'm less on the noir tip than you are. So I feel like I would like to know your answer to that question.
I really like her. I think her performance is really good, and I really like this character a lot. I like that it's not overly sexualized. I mean, we know that Sam's attracted to her and that, you know, things happen between them, and she describes using her feminine wiles to, you know, get her way in the past. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, with noir kind of eventually gets those really long kind of male gazey moments eventually at all the female characters, and they're all very kind of mysterious and scheming and over sexualized, I guess. And I know that, you know, this person is mysterious and definitely is scheming, but there's something that's played a bit more real about this one, and I don't know if it's just before that fatale got out of control and or kind of got solidified to be one.
She got
thing
too fatale and not enough.
Yeah. yeah, I guess. No, but I really like her, and I don't distrust her right away, even mm-hmm. knowing she's the female character in a noir movie, which means never trust her.
Yeah.
I don't know. I really liked her, and I liked her performance a lot. And I liked I liked the slow reveal of how much she was into it, and just a lot of the things about how she ropes people in. I really enjoyed a lot, and I liked when they said, you know, we didn't believe you, we believed your $200. I liked a lot of the deception that goes on between her and Sam and Miles, you know, while he's alive.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And I also like when she's you know, having to play up for him, and she's, you know, looking for sympathy and trying to act all scared and doing the schoolgirl act, as he calls it. Mm-hmm. And Sam Spade is the wrong person to try that kind of stuff on. Like a little bit at a time, just enough to kind of get to the next plot point, just enough to kind of keep him involved. And Sam's really seems really in control this whole movie, and doesn't you know, really rely on others or get caught up in emotion. But it's incredible how he, up until almost that last fifth of the movie, which is pretty much one confrontation scene, he really is fooled for a lot of it.
Yeah.
And acting very confidently. And I mean, he still is doing a lot of things correct and finding out some information. But I think this is one of my favorite, like, femme fatales, even though it's not exactly what that archetype would go on to become. But yeah. I think she's fantastic in this.
Well, I think the things that are always end up being the best are the ones that do kind of break out of the archetype a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
You kind of have to be the outlier to stand apart. I mean, that's the definition of the term. But, you know, like it's important that she is a little bit different. Otherwise, you would know exactly what she was going to do all the time, right?
Yeah,
and that's not interesting.
Yeah, but what's interesting to me is that this was the first one. Like,
yeah.
This isn't.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
They've done this character so many times. Now we need to switch it up. It kind of started with this, and I think the femme fatale went on to be like a really kind of really stylized, unrealistic character. Whereas in this one, I think he's just going from a detective story, and that translates, I think, really, really well onto film in a more naturalistic way than what we're going to get later in the genre or subgenre.
Yep.
I like her a lot. If you couldn't tell.
Yeah. I like that she is constantly covered in bars throughout the movie.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. And I mean, we get noir altogether. We get a lot of claustrophobia. We get a lot of scenes designed or frames designed where people are kind of, you know, back. You get a lot of
ceilings in this one specifically.
In this one, yeah, we get tons of ceilings,
which is very, very uncommon before this movie and Citizen Kane.
Yeah, and I think that's something that you can watch this movie and that really doesn't stand out as remarkable for the 40s. I mean, you just kind of think that it's just a low angle shot, but. Mm-hmm. A lot of these times they're filming in rooms that didn't even have roofs, right?
Yeah,
like
they
didn't have a ceiling. So in order to do these low angle shots, which are something that ends up being a big part of noir, you don't just lower the camera built a bit and tilt it upward. You're changing the structure of the set and what you can do. And that affects your lighting, that affects so much other stuff when filming a movie, right? So
that
stylistic choice, which, you know, can make people seem big and looming or make people seem cornered and scared, it's a good visual choice, and it's not one that's just as easy as adjusting one thing. It's a very, to use the word again, deliberate choice that you need to plan for, and we know John Huston did that. And Citizen Kane's shooting, you know, across town at the same time this is being filmed.
I know, it's really crazy that this and Citizen Kane come out in the same year, but like what you talked about, it adds a realism that, one, doesn't look like realism anymore because we've just come so far. Like, people, you know, you have to look very close to a location. Otherwise, people are like, oh, this is bullshit now. Whereas this is still clearly a set, but it's a set with a ceiling. And in 1941, that would be miles more realistic than a set with no ceiling, or, you know, where you don't see the ceiling. But and like you said, it does add to the claustrophobic element of the movie, because I mean, the whole structure of the movie is basically Sam getting more and more into a corner, getting him stuck more and more into a corner that leads to that last scene that's about half an hour long. But it's all about him being backed into that corner and then him using that half hour to get himself out of it. You know, it's like the ceiling just probably kind of goes away at some point in that scene, you know, and he's finally able to go free. He's finally able to get himself out. But yeah, you're exactly right. It adds exactly one more element of claustrophobia to it in that it's, you know, an extra barrier.
Yeah. Oh, right. And so what you said that made me think of that was the prison bars. And, you know, with noir, we get a lot of claustrophobia, and we get tons of shadows. I mean, it's all over this movie.
Yeah,
too.
I love really the shadows in this movie. It's kind of like, I mean, it's everywhere. It's not just on the people. Even just the light fixtures have very obvious shadows, which is, you know, typically a no-no in filmmaking. You're not supposed to have a lot of shadows if avoidable. But you know, they're going out of their way to have shadows in this movie, and I like it because it's sort of like every character has multiple sort of like there's two people. It's the person that you see and the person that they actually are hiding behind them, and that's what a shadow kind of is. And that's what I like so much about the shadows in this movie specifically. I think they're used very well,
and it's so many of these people are pretending to be someone else or pretending to work under some motivation, so that works. And you know, this is 1941, so America's involvement in World War II hasn't really come about yet at the time of this release, so let alone this was being made. But the disillusionment after World War II is a big thing that helped shape the noir genre. And so just the idea of shadows and the idea of you know, consequences, I think, is one thing that The Shadows remind me a lot of in noir, and that, you know, you have this thing, you know, you have this, you know, for your example, you have this lamp, and that's that. But then there's this shadow, there's this other thing, there's its true nature, there's the true dark, the darkness of what really took place, or of who these people are. And, you know, casting a shadow has kind of worked its way into our lexicon for that reason. It's all these kind of horrible things that have these long-lasting consequences. And in noir, and in this too, you get long shadows too. Like, you get the shadow that's bigger than the object. So you have something like World War II, you have something like the Great Depression, you have these things that, you know, depending on how long they took place is one thing, but then there's also this tail, there's also this long-reaching effect. And, you know, as I said, this is before America is in World War II, but World War II ended with nuclear bombs, and those have very long lasting effects. And I think my favorite fact about this whole movie is the fact that the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki are named Fat Man and Little Boy, which is what Mr. Gutman and Wilmer are nicknamed in this movie. So that's one of my favorite things about this, and the fact that it ties together with the World War II and lasting consequences, and just how big this movie was. Like, this movie was huge at the time, and again, has long lasting effects and consequences. And just to see how much this movie was in the culture consciousness to play a huge part in human history by naming the bombs after them, I think is very, very incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Venetian blinds are big in all of noir and kind of casting those shadows for those reasons I just listed. But in this movie, only one character goes to jail, and it's the one with the striped pajamas, the one who's constantly has, you know, bars shadowed over her, the one who we get that shot of her going in the elevator. And like, it's one of the good things about having those elevators. You get your prison visual metaphors very easily.
Yeah, exactly.
If it hadn't been made clear already.
Yeah. As long as you're doing your arrests in a modern building on an upper floor, you're set. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And in the scene where she's basically begging Spade not to turn her in, the blinds behind her are just like, it's even more of drapes, but yeah, they're drapes, but the shadows of them somehow end up looking like bars directly behind her. And and she has a pair of striped chairs in her house as well. So yeah, there's a lot of bars following Miss O'Shaughnessy around.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And as I said, I mean, there's negative consequences for a lot of people in this movie, but she's the only one we know who goes off to jail, and we've been given hints of that since the beginning.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I like that a lot too. I thought I had one more thing to say about Shaughnessy. Oh yeah, just you know, talking about how they wanted happy endings of this movie, and pretty much all movies at that time. It's not a pleasant ending, and it's a very pessimistic nature. Like, the MacGuffin, the Maltese Falcon, chose to be fake, was a counterfeit. So all the action, all the murder and arson and taxi drives to empty lots was all for nothing.
Yep.
You know, just what has driven this? What these people's lives are shaped by is a lie, and it's a counterfeit. It's worthless, or almost worthless. And for Spade in that ending, like, he's someone who is pretty cold, and you know, he's good at his job, he's just not really kind to people along the way. And then he does find O'Shaughnessy, and even knowing how she's been playing him and what a liar she is and all the illegal activity that she's been mixed up with in the past, Sam Spade really still falls for her, and, you know, does not want to send her to jail, but he, you know, that's his code and that's what he lives by. And so for him, it's like, he's this really cold guy, it seems, in this really cold world, who, you know, manages to find love, but it can't be. Like, love exists, you can just never have it. It's such a pessimistic ending to me that is an ending that I really love, but just drives home the pessimistic nature of this movie and what would become the genre that it spawned. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. Just quickly, I think the love stuff is far and away the worst aspect of this movie, and I don't think comes across well at all.
Why
I understand.
Do you say that?
I just don't buy any of it. There's just so little of it, and I don't I don't think either of them fully buys into the idea. And it just all feels, that's the part of this movie that feels incredibly forced to me. And I do agree that the ending is very wonderful, and in that it's incredibly dark. But I love the line, you know, what is this, the stuff that dreams are made of? I believe that's the last line of the movie. It's Spade describing the Maltese Falcon. It's a thing that's too good to be true.
The American dream, as you said.
Yeah, exactly.
So many other things. Many other MacGuffins. Yeah.
It's this thing we're spending all this time chasing for no reason. To find out that it's a lie. But yeah, the love stuff just really didn't work for me. But that doesn't take away from the ending of the movie, because he's still not getting a thing that he's been trying so hard to get, you know, and adding to what you said about how it being very interesting for the time and all that stuff. It's also ended up being kind of a calling card of John Huston, is that characters that spend all this time trying to get this object or this thing end up losing in the end. And it's really interesting. And in this movie specifically, it's really fascinating. And yeah, the cool removed guy is the only one that survives. gets away clean, you know. The Fat Man and Cairo are still off chasing the impossible dream, but he's like, well, it's over. I'm gonna...
I love that though. They're like, well, this one's fake. Back to Istanbul.
We got a hot lead. It's in Istanbul.
To Istanbul. Yeah. Do you have anything else to say about Maltese Falcon?
No.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. So thank you for listening. Unless you have anything else to say, that tends to be your wrapping it up question.
No, I think... nothing of importance.
Okay. Would you say that this film is the stuff that dreams are made of?
I will do what this movie does and save the real last line for the question, huh? And then fade to black, because that's how this really ends.
I forgot that. Well, thank you for listening to MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about Casablanca. So if you didn't get enough Bogart this week, you'll get some more next week. All right, see ya.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.